This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
I am so pleased to welcome Helene Cooper this evening to discuss her new book, Madam President, The Extraordinary Journey of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Cooper's a New York Times Pentagon correspondent. She's worked at the Times for more than 10 years in a variety of roles, including White House correspondent and diplomatic correspondent. And in 2015, she was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting for her work in Liberia during the Ebola epidemic. Liberia is a country she knows well. It's where she was born, and she wrote a best-selling and highly acclaimed memoir called The House on Sugar Beach, about her African childhood and her eponymous family home, and how that life was interrupted by the violent coup in 1980. She now turns her attention back to Liberia, this time to President Sirleaf, the two-term first democratically elected female president in African history and the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. The Washington Post has called this book more than the life story of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, but an expansive and penetrating narrative of a country that sweeps across continents and time. We had President Sirleaf in the store not too long ago, maybe about a year ago, and we're now pleased to have Helene Cooper here to illuminate this woman who has been called an oracle and Liberia's greatest daughter. And Helene is here fresh from The Daily Show, so please help me welcome Helene Cooper.
Hello. It's God, I love politics and prose because it's like I know everybody in the audience. And I think I saw my sister out there wearing a shirt of mine that I haven't seen in a few years. Honey, I want that back. Thank you guys for coming on this rainy night. It's great to see all of you. Thank you so much for that introduction. For me, this book began 12 years ago while I was on a reporting trip in Eastern Congo. I didn't know it at the time, but I never seemed to realize when I'm in the middle of something seminal that's happening to me. I had been on assignment for the New York Times in Bukavu as part of a series of stories I was doing about development and poverty in Africa. I went to Ghana, to Ethiopia, to Kenya. And I remember with each place I arrived, I kept thinking that despite the poverty and the challenges, none of them seemed as bad off as my home country of Liberia. Until, that is, I got to Bukavu. Oh, finally, now I'm home, I thought as I crawled out of this small single-engine plane. After the semi-desert of Ethiopia and the savannas of Kenya, Bukavu was otherworldly lush, just like my home country of Liberia. Leafy green mountains, rich banana trees, the same luxuriant, verdant landscape that we have in Liberia. And the same sense of abandonment that comes from having a population ravaged by years of pointless civil wars. Hundreds of boys trolled the streets with nowhere to go. Downtown buildings were pockmarked with bullet holes and grenades. The only cars were the white United Nations SUVs. What struck me most, though, in Bukavu were the women. As I drove into the city, I passed women I had known all of my life. There were old women with huge bundles of bamboo sticks on their backs. There were market women in their colorful dresses huddled at the side of the road, selling oranges, eggs, nuts. There were young girls sitting in front of huts, bathing their little brothers and sisters. No electricity was anywhere around, but one 10-year-old girl had dragged a bucket of dirty creek water up the hill to her house so she could wash her 4-year-old sister. These were the women that I grew up with in Liberia, the women all across Africa, the worst place there is to be a woman, who somehow managed to carry that continent on their backs. I remember one woman in particular who stood out to me in Bukavu. It was twilight when I passed her, and she was trudging up the hill with all these logs on her shoulders. Her husband was walking just in front of her. He carried nothing. Nothing on his back, nothing in his hands, nothing. He kept turning around and telling her to hurry up. That image has stayed with me for 12 years. A few months after my trip to Bukavu, I was back in the United States when the women of Liberia, my home country, staged an incredible power play. Defying centuries of history in the most patriarchal place of places, they flooded to the polls and staged a democratic coup. They upended years of male rule and voted for Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to be president of Liberia, the first woman to be democratically elected president of Africa, in Africa. I knew instantly that I wanted to write about this. This book, in the end, looks at how it happened, what it took to upend all those years of male rule in Liberia. It's also a book about what drove the women who put her in power. And it's a book that looks at how they did it, how these women got so fed up with being exploited and raped and assaulted that they decided that the only way forward was to turn the tables on the men any way that they could. In 1985, a young Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was thrown into jail by Samuel Doe, then the president of Liberia. She was put in a cell next to men condemned to die. She listened in that cell as the men next door to her were executed by firing squad. Afterwards, Ellen sat in the corner of the fetid cell, her eyes squeezed shut, her lips moving silently as she prayed, wondering if the soldiers would rape her before they killed her. Hours passed. Outside, the soldiers drank and became even rowdier. Then, just past midnight, one soldier walked up to her cell, stood at the bars, and stared at her. Several minutes passed in silence. Then he said, "I'm going to fuck you." He opened the cell door, and Ellen rose to her seat, her heart pounding. But just as the soldier was entering her cell, a voice behind him said, "As you were." The soldier dropped his hands. "Retreat," said the voice. The soldier closed the cell door, locked it, and moved away. Her savior stepped forward into the light. He was slightly older than the others, in his mid-20s, with beautiful dark skin and a serious face. Looking at him, Ellen wanted to cry. "They say you gula?" he asked her. "Mapa gula," she replied. "Say something in gula." "Ise." "Way apatang." "Jelijua," she said. Her rescuer stared at her for what felt like forever. Finally, he said, "Okay, I will stay here tonight. Nobody will humbug you." So on that night, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was not raped, but someone else was. A young Gio girl, who also had been captured and brought to Shefflin, was gang raped by soldiers there in the early hours of the morning as Ellen huddled in her cell. Whether Ellen's would-be rapist took part as well, she would never know. After brutalizing the girl, the soldiers brought her naked and crying hysterically to Ellen's cell. She was bleeding, and her eyes were wild with fear. She looked to be around 19 or 20. Jumping up, Ellen put her arms around her and lowered her onto the floor. In the corner, the two rocked back and forth, clutching each other. Slowly, the girl's cries softened. Her naked body started to tremble. Leaving her new cellmate for a moment, Ellen went to the bars. There were a few soldiers milling around alongside the one who had rescued her. "Eme, you think about your manem," Ellen said, her voice shaking. The soldiers looked at her. She tried again. "Think about your sisters." Still nothing. "I beg you, at least bring blapa or something for the child to wear." Finally, one of the men left and brought back a piece of cloth, and Ellen helped the girl cover herself. For the rest of the night, the two huddled side by side. They didn't sleep, just sat and rocked back and forth as the minutes ticked away until dawn, when the soldiers came for Ellen. As she walked to the jeep, Ellen looked at her young Gio cellmate. The two women had spent less than half a night together. One was now going to face the man she was certain would be her executioner. The other was staying with the men who were certain to rape her again. The jeep pulled away, and Ellen turned in her seat to stare at the young girl. She would never see this young woman again. But in many ways, that young Gio girl would change the course of history in West Africa. That Gio girl would become the stick of fuel for the fire of the women's movement in Liberia. Little girls do not come out of the womb vowing to become activists for female power. They don't spend their childhood thinking about how they will repair the indignities, large and small, that bleed women daily. It's a series of things that multiply and turn ordinary women into movements of female determination. You're living your life, sweeping floors at Rennenbaum Drugstore in Madison, Wisconsin, when your husband storms in to yell at you in front of your white boss lady. You're stunned by the violent shock of a hand slapping your face, delivered by the man who promised to love, honor, and cherish you till death do you part. You feel the warm, wet skin of a brutalized, naked, hysterical young woman as she crouches on the corner, bleeding after being savaged by the men who swore an oath to protect Liberia and her people. I wanted to be a schoolteacher like my mother, Ellen said, looking back 30 years later. Describing that night at the Shefflin Barracks, she would use the mental sleight of hand that is common among survivors of unimaginable horror. She would relay the events of that night with no emotion whatsoever. The joyride on the beach, which the soldier told her would be her execution site. The useless pleas from the condemned men that she find a way for them to be spared. The overwhelming terror of men who know that they're about to die. The overwhelming terror of knowing you're about to be raped. The gut-clenching anger of holding a young woman after she has been raped by soldier after soldier after soldier after soldier. That's what I wanted to do when I was young, Ellen said, to teach. But the young Ellen may have started off wanting to teach, but this was not a woman who was destined for the granular. Hers would be a different destiny, one launched in a Jeep by the young Gio girl who had been her cellmate. President Doe didn't realize it, but in locking Ellen Johnson Sirleaf up in jail, he created both an international cause celeb and ignited the women's movement in Liberia. All across Liberia, young women were riveted by the story of this jailed female political dissident who's standing up to the men running the country. Eventually, after a year and under pressure from women's groups in the international community, Doe released Ellen, but he had created a monster. The stage was now set for the revolution that would overturn gender politics in West Africa. But the men still had one more act to play, and it was a doozy. I could stand up here for hours going on about what Charles Taylor did to Liberia, but that would be the subject of his own book. The tribal war he started, the child soldiers, the hundreds of thousands of people killed, the wars he launched in Sierra Leone and the Ivory Coast. He kidnapped children from their terrified mothers. His forces went on a raping and killing spree that spared almost no one. Once again, as they had so many times before, it was the Liberian women that carried the country through. While the men were waging war, the women in Liberia all became market women, traveling by foot to the border to get food to bring back to a starving population. They had the babies of their rapists in the forest, strapped those babies on their backs, and went back into their market stalls or sat on the side of the road selling oranges. And they bided their time. When the war finally ended, they made their power play. In 2005, 11 years before Pantsuit Nation became a secret Facebook group, and I'm With Her buttons and bumper stickers sprouted on lapels and SUVs here in America, the women of Liberia held a master class on how to get a woman elected president. They had the perfect vehicle for their guerrilla campaign, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, a woman who was supremely qualified, who by far outqualified the men who were running, but who also had no qualms whatsoever about playing dirty politics and fighting any dirt that the men could fling with dirtier dirt. The election came down to a choice between the 67-year-old Harvard grad educated global bureaucrat and the professional football player, George Weah. Now, George Weah was a world-renowned football player, a star in Europe when he was a striker for the Italian team AC Milan. In 1995, Weah won the Ballon d'Or and was named the FIFA World Player of the Year and the African Player of the Century. Two goals in particular stood out. One was against Byron in 1994 when he embarrassed not one or two, but three Byron defenders with his quick pivots before letting rip a gorgeous sally into the near post. The other goal, known around the world even today as the goal, was in 1996 when Weah destroyed the Verona midfield as he single-handedly slalomed his way down the pitch, twisting, turning, bucking, and weaving all the way to the Verona goal in a legendary performance that Liberians, who watched it using their makeshift Tiger batteries because there was no electricity, still talked about a decade later. That Weah had no real college education didn't bother his youthful supporters, who countered that that Verona goal showed his own education. At the other end of the spectrum was Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, finance minister under former President Talbert, dissident against former President Doe, United Nations, World Bank, IMF pedigree, ally, then turned foe of Taylor. She had morphed from an abused wife, cowering and hunched in the front seat of her husband's car while he slapped her, to an international bureaucrat, an iconic political dissident, who was attempting to do something no woman had ever done before, win by popular vote the right to lead an African country. The men fell in line behind George Weah and then complained that the women supporting Ellen was sexist. It was a remarkable display. Given the choice between a football player with no credible college education, but two fantastic goals against Byron and Verona, and a Harvard-educated development expert, the top male presidential candidates who fell short in the runoff, with one exception, endorsed the football player. Weah, meanwhile, honing his message for why he, and not the old lady, should run Liberia, settled on an educated people failed theme. You know book, you not know book, I will vote for you, became the Weah runoff slogan. And that theme was endorsed by the failed male presidential candidates who backed him. Liberia had one of the lowest literacy rates in the world, so an illiterate population would identify with a president who dropped out of school, right? Wrong. What the men who endorsed that strategy failed to realize is how much the very idea was pissing off the market women. These women may not have been educated themselves, but they worked day and night in the fields and the market stalls to send their children to school. Now the men were telling them that education wasn't important. Just as the men fell in behind Weah, the women fell in behind Ellen. It didn't happen at once. Female political candidates had appeared all over the ballot in the first round, running for Senate and House on the same ticket as Weah and the other male candidates. But once the time came for campaigning for the runoff, these allegiances peeled away as even the women who were staunch members of parties that opposed Ellen's Unity Party abandoned the men and took up the new mantra, vote for a woman. Door to door, the market women passed out T-shirts and handed out flyers. They slept on the side of the road at night, curled up on their mats. They walked from village to village, exhorting women to vote for a woman. Weah supporters responded by predicting that if he lost, the country would go back to war. No Weah, no peace, they chanted. Thus, the runoff started resembling past elections, like the one in 1985, in which Doe's supporters had suggested the same thing, vote for Doe or the country goes back to war. In Liberia, this tactic was how men managed to get their way. They simply threatened the people. Except that in November 2005, they appeared to have met their match. Because the women had their own tricks. Tricks that would make Weah's tactics look like boys' play. You want beer? Just give me a voter ID card. I will buy you beer. I say we buy voter ID cards, oh, 10 Liberty dollars for one. Who looking for money? Just bring your voter ID card. The group of women had stationed themselves at a bar at the ELWA junction, a major intersection in Monrovia, along the road to Roberts Field. The women set to work, luring the young men in a time-honored fashion. Except this time, it wasn't sex on the table. And this time, the women were the ones with the cash, and the young men were the ones with the commodity for sale. Some of the boys were finished stupid, one market woman recalled with a smirk. She was happy to go into detail about what she called the women's crafty techniques. We were crafty, she said, one silver tooth glinting in the sunshine as she laughed. Many of the young men thought they were done with voting after the first round and didn't understand that they would need their voter ID cards again if their man was to actually assume the presidency. Others knew and didn't care. Late in the evening, on a muggy hot day, the lure of a crisp, cold, multi-club beer far outshone whatever benefits they thought their voter cards would bring them. As for the ones who were too smart to sell their voter cards, well, their moms just stole them. Some of those Omane, when they're cheering how hard he is, they're still voting for George Weah, they stole their cheering and voter cards, Parley Harris said, looking sheepish and defiant at the same time. One market woman, who agreed to be referred to as the Oma, said she snuck into her son's room while he was sleeping, slipped his voter ID card out of his wallet, and buried it in the yard. Years later, there was no shame among the women who stole their son's ID cards. Yeah, I took it, and so what? The Oma said. That foolish boy, what he knew? I carried him for 9 months. I took care of him. I fed him when he was hungry. Then he would take people's children and people's country and give it away. You would get elephant here to child to carry? After burying their son's voter ID cards, the women supporting Ellen then dug up an old video of a naked George Weah. Somehow, a 14-year-old commercial for cologne that we have made in Italy just happened to surface in the Liberian media. In the commercial, Weah, at the time a world-famous striker with the football team AC Milan, walks into a restaurant to greet his white dinner date after dousing himself in cologne. He's fully clothed at the beginning, but when the woman sees him from across the room, she's so overcome that she imagines him naked. The commercial then cuts to a naked Weah strolling across the restaurant to his date, while other white women in the restaurant drool and fan themselves. Finally, Weah arrives at the table, leans over it toward his date, and smiles. When he sits down, he's clothed again, and he says, suavely, "Tutto bene." To get an idea of how this commercial played in Liberia, you have to understand this country's Bible-spouting Puritanism and deep racial anxieties. Many of the freed American slaves who founded Liberia were the mixed-race children of white slave owners who proceeded to set up the same kind of society from which they had fled, except this time the lighter-skinned colonists were the upper class, lording it over the native Liberians. So matters of race still struck deep into the heart of the Liberians. That's why for many Liberians, it was bad enough that Weah was strutting around naked on Italian TV. But in front of white women, oh no, that was too much. "Weah walks butt naked," screamed the headline in the new Democrat newspaper, which provided this hilarious synopsis of the commercial for those without access to YouTube. "The video scene portrays white women in looks of sexual awe and ecstasy, glancing at the black man with his athletic build and muscular features, exposing his genitals, flipping, walking before them." Weah's political supporters tried to brazen their way out. "Mr. Weah committed no crime by posing butt naked," one party official helpfully told reporters. "Only constitutional deviants should not be elected." But the body politic quickly dusted off their holier-than-thou cloaks, adopting the convoluted sentence structure at which Liberian men were particularly adept. Joshua Duncan Freedom, principal of the King Pentecostal High School, told reporters, "If the Congress for Democratic Change, through its vocal spokesperson Acarius Gray, can justify George Weah's butt-naked video on the international information superhighway on some kind of constitutional right, then Liberians must be prepared, God forbid, under the CDC rule to give audience to the legality and normalness of murder and even cannibalism." The truth is, this cloak of religious indignation simply covered up what Liberians of both sexes were really mad about, that Weah was flashing his oiled, well-chiseled body, buttocks included, in front of white women. Liberian women saw it as a rejection of black women. Liberian men were jealous. Either way, it was a loser issue for Weah, as Ellen's supporters knew it would be. On Tuesday, November 8th, the people of Liberia woke up and went to the polls for the second time in 4 weeks. There was a real and palpable sense in the air that something big was happening. Helpful poll workers at a polling station, Sincor, were allowing pregnant women and nursing mothers to cut to the front of the line. So Bernice Freeman, Louise Yase, and a handful of other women were passing around babies and toddlers. You won't borrow it, baby? Bernice was grinning at one woman, sneaking a furtive look over her shoulder. Put it, baby, on your back. To another woman, she advised, act pregnant. If they think you're pregnant, you can vote in front. It was unclear whether the poll workers noticed how many different women were carrying the same baby. The Oma was in the Lido. That night, a bunch of women were listening to the election news when an informant came in with an update. The official results weren't in yet. Some polls were still open. The final tally wouldn't be known for weeks, but already there was a whisper in the air from Ellen's spies posted at different polling places. People weren't supposed to disclose voting trends at the polling booths for fear of swaying those who hadn't cast their vote yet. But all across the country, Ellen's army of women were finding ways to skirt the regulation. For Lusu Sloan, the workaround came by reverting to an old nursery school chant used to teach children the alphabet. S-O-S-O, G-O-G-O, N-O-N-O. Every Liberian kid knows this chant. For Lusu on runoff night, the chant took on a new meaning. Hanging outside a polling booth, she nervously asked an informant how the vote was going. He eyed the voting officials in attendance, then grinned slyly. S-O-S-O, G-O-G-O, N-O-N-O, he sang. Then he added, U-P up! Unity Party, up! Lusu started dancing and singing in glee. S-O-S-O, G-O-G-O, N-O-N-O, U-P up! U-P up! When the election officials glared at her, she sassed them. You can't stop me from singing my S-O-S-O, she said. U-P up! She went to bed that night singing. The old lady was in the lead. On Wednesday morning, Ellen woke up and walked into her living room to find it already full of campaign aides, excited about the preliminary results from Lofa and Nimba counties. She wasn't just in the lead. She was in the lead by a lot, 60% to 40%. It was a lead that she never relinquished during the days of counting that followed. The old lady would be Madam President. Out of the 25 years of carnage that was Liberia's descent into hell had emerged a new leader, and that person was a 67-year-old grandma. On November 23rd, after the results were announced, Ellen was headed back to her house from campaign headquarters, juggling congratulatory phone calls from all over the world. In the back seat of her SUV, her American friend Steve Cashin turned to her, grinning. The White House just called. President Bush wants to talk to you, he said, then recited a very secure, encrypted phone number. Call that number. A minute later, Ellen was on the phone with the American president, accepting his congratulations. Then the phone went dead. Liberia in 2005 had no landlines thanks to the war, so everyone used cell phones. They paid for service from Lone Star Cell by purchasing scratch cards from grown-up boys on the side of the road. The president-elect of Liberia had just run out of credit on her scratch card. Turning to Cashin, Ellen smirked. This isn't very presidential at all, is it? When word spread about Ellen's victory, the markets of Monrovia emptied as the women who minded the stalls at Rally Time and Nancy Doe and Red Light and Painesville ran jubilant into the streets. Go to school, go to school, some of them yelled. Don't play football. I still think about that woman I saw in Bukavu in the Congo all those years ago. You know, the one walking with her husband, carrying all those logs on her back. In so many ways, I think this book is for her. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions. I'm not taking any questions from any of my relatives. Let me just tell you guys that now. Okay, colleagues are okay.
Can you say the elephant head quote again? I'm not sure everybody got it.
I think I was clear that I'm not taking questions from relatives. Do I need to repeat that?
Surely we
This is easy. Yes.
You didn't speak about the other tactic the women used about the knees together.
That wasn't really used during the election. That was used to stop the war in 2003.
Okay.
What was that again?
In 2003, a lot of the women, this was when Charles Taylor was getting ready to, he was being driven out of Liberia. There were all these different factions, warlords who were fighting and were refusing to attend peace talks. And many of the women in Liberia began praying for peace, and they began this women's movement that, in which they were wearing white T-shirts. They were gathered in these fields right on Tubman Boulevard near Sprixpain Airport, and they started denying sex to their husbands. It's a very Lysistratus type move, but they were insisting that the country had gone through enough with the war, for a war that had been going through for 14 years at that point. And that is when that tactic started. And a lot of these same women are the women who ended up campaigning for Ellen in 2005.
So I'm just curious, how did Ellen end up going to Harvard? I mean, how did that happen? And I'm just curious, how did you end up at the New York Times? I mean, how do two hotshot Liberian women end up in great places?
'Cause we're smart. Ellen went to Madison Business College. She got a scholarship when she was 21. This was a big decision for her because she got married at the age of 17 and then had four boys, one after the other. So she had four boys. The youngest one was under the age of one at the time when her husband, Doc Sirleaf, got a scholarship to go to college in Wisconsin. And so she went and applied for one, and she had a seminal decision to make at that point because now it's like 1962 Liberia, and she has four young boys, and this is sort of the question that so many women face: children or career. And she was already at that time sort of seeing the life she could have if she didn't get an education. It would basically be, you know, sort of subservient to her husband and, you know, going to the store and taking the children around all day, but not really the kind of life she wanted. And so she made the decision to leave her sons with the grandmothers and followed her husband to Wisconsin. She got an associate's degree. She stayed in Madison for 2 years and then went back to Liberia, where she got a job as a junior official in the debt department at the Ministry of Finance. This was a very big deal for a woman, a young woman at that time, in that time of the that period of time, to get that kind of a job, and she loved it. And that's sort of what started her on her way. She caught the attention of a Harvard economist a couple of years later, Gustav Papanek, who was having this big economic conference in Liberia, and he wanted a Liberian official to give the keynote speech for that conference. But he thought all the men who wanted to do it were just going to talk nonsense because they didn't seem to notice all of the economic disparities in the country. He had met Ellen and thought she seemed to be aware of all that was going on. So she walks up to the stage at this big economic conference, and all of her bosses are there, and all of the elite of Liberia is there. And she works for the Ministry of Finance, and she announces at the stage that this is a country run by kleptocrats. That didn't go over well, which is why she beat it. And Papanek at the time was like, you know what, maybe you should get out of the country right now. And he helped her to get a scholarship at Harvard. Oh, and me. My family moved here in 1980. I after the military coup in Liberia. I think I was always very interested in journalism. It's something I suck at, math and science and anything like that. I had been very sheltered up until the point that the military coup happened in Liberia. And I think I also kind of wanted to never be surprised about what was going on around me again, which is sort of what attracted me to journalism as well. And then I read All the President's Men, and that was pretty much all she wrote.
Hi. I know it's a little bit of a broad question, but can you tell me about your thought process of writing this book? And I remember you said, you know, you heard about this and you immediately wanted to write about it, but, like, can you walk us through your thought process?
Sure. I was still, this happened, I've been in the Congo where I saw this woman in April. The Liberian elections happened in October and November of the same year. And sure, I was completely shocked because leading up to that point, whenever Liberia was in the news, it was something horrific. It was child soldiers, it was the war, which was awful. And then all of a sudden you're going from that, and I started going back to Liberia again after Charles Taylor left, but the country was in such horrible shape. And then out of the clear blue, it felt like to me over here in the States, the women elect a woman president. It was just such a fantastical thing that I thought I want to get to the bottom of this. When I started talking then to Liberians who were involved in the campaign, and they started telling me, I remember my friend Philip Parker visiting and sitting in my living room and telling me, and then the women did this, and then they did that. And as a journalist, you're just sitting there thinking, I got to write about this. The problem is I wasn't done at that point with my other book. And so it's sort of, you know, I had to finish my first book. I still had my day job, and it took a long time. And then I made a deal with the Times after I was covering the Obama White House, which I hated. And I was like, I want to go on book leave. And Dean Baquet, who's my boss at the time, said, if you stick it out for the entire first term, you can have a book leave in 2013. And that's how I ended up getting the time off to start working on the book. And then I thought I was done in 2014. I'd finished my second draft, and things were going good, and the publishers liked it, and then Ebola happened. And so I had to put it down and say, okay, there's no way I can write a book about Ellen Johnson Sirleaf until I look at how she handles this. So I guess I tend to take a long time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd be, thanks very much, and I look forward to reading the book. I'd be interested in how you see the future now. Ellen must be close to 80 now.
She's 78.
78. There's elections coming up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see? Are you optimistic that it's all going to
I am
work
optimistic.
Out?
I hope. I mean, I don't. A lot of the same characters who ran before are running again, including the football player. So that part is going to be interesting. But I think at the end of the day, she's had a lot of issues. And I don't want to stand here and pretend that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has had a perfect two terms, because she hasn't. She hasn't done anywhere near enough on corruption. It's still endemic throughout the Liberian government. There are valid charges of nepotism. She's appointed her son, one son in particular, to high government office. The country is still struggling, even though it's in way. I mean, the difference between what it was like in 2005 compared to now is like not. It's a completely different country. But she has been by far better than any of the men before her. I think one of the reasons why I'm optimistic, and this is directly because of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is because she has put in place freedom of speech and freedom of the press now to the point that the political discourse in Liberia is completely free. You have so much criticism of the government without people being afraid that they're going to be thrown in jail as they were in the past. People are quick to hold the government to account. Again and again and again. And I think that's one of the reasons why Liberia came out of the Ebola epidemic faster than Sierra Leone or Guinea, because Liberians went crazy and they demanded action from the government. And the government was under a lot of pressure. Whereas in Sierra Leone and Guinea, I don't know what those guys were doing. They had their heads in the sand a lot longer than she did. So I think because of the freedom of speech and freedom of the press that we have in Liberia now, Liberians are going to be less willing to tolerate going back to the past. And I think they will hold whoever is elected more to account. Yes.
I keep thinking about our recent election. I don't suppose you dare comment.
What? Here's my standard line on the comparison. Look, what I think I've come up with is, if you're a woman running for president, and this was the case of the Ellen, a lot of the men are not going to vote for you. You saw with all those male candidates in Liberia who knew better. I mean, I talked to them after. I talked to Winston Tubman after. I was like, how could you have endorsed George Weah? And this guy is a guy who was well-educated, all of that, but he was pretty compromised. But that said, how could you endorse a football player for our country, which is, if you think about the shape Liberia was in 2005, the kind of job that was needed to bring this country out of it, how could you possibly think that somebody, that George Weah could have done it? And his response was that, look, you know, Ellen was a woman, and on beyond that, I knew that I would have more influence with a George Weah government than I would with Ellen. But this was the case with so many of the male presidential candidates who threw their weight behind George Weah. She had a much lower percentage of the male vote than you would have expected, but she really made up for it with the female vote. She had more than 80% of the women. You didn't see Hillary Clinton with that here. Hillary Clinton did not get a majority of the white woman vote. She got 94% of the black women vote, and she got a majority of the Asian and Latino, but the white women did not fall in behind her, and she got a much lower percentage of the male vote than Barack Obama did. So I think what I've come up with, there you are, is that if you're a female candidate, you really got to, you kind of have to have the women make up for the fact that you're going to have some issues with the men. Yes, sir.
I'd like to know if you have had much contact with the women from South Africa and the political infrastructure there.
I have not.
I see. Okay. Because there is a strong women's organization. A number of women in South Africa have really risen to the front, and there's a very active political infrastructure. But violence is part of it, unfortunately, as well.
I think that's the case all around Africa. I think Africa, in many ways, is way ahead of the United States when it comes to women in political offices and women in political power. And I'm pretty optimistic that you're going to see other women stepping to the front in other African countries.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm very much looking forward to reading your book, and I suspect you're going to address this in that, but being impatient, how did these women get this going in the first place? Like, what were the seminal things? How do you take a country where people are so dispersed and you don't have the communication systems that we do and get this thing going?
These women were already running the country. That's the fundamental problem. These market women had been running this country economically for years. The men were all fighting, and the women were the ones who had these networks, and they had these routes that they went to the borders to get food, and they were the ones who had the economic power. What little money was there to be had in the country was held by the market women, because it's just a matter of realizing that they could flip that economic power to political power. These were the women. It goes back again to that image of that woman in the Congo carrying the logs and her husband's not carrying anything. If you're not used to doing anything, you know, you're not going to be able to touch somebody who's been working day in and day out in the fields and doing the kind of stuff that they've been doing. Yes.
Hi. My question is whether she has helped to build a sort of political infrastructure so that other women coming up behind her can take office at various levels of government?
Not really. I don't think she has. There are plenty of women in, you know, mayors and superintendents of counties, but that has not been something that she's done. I don't think she gets high marks for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Vasu. I'm from India originally. I work at the World Bank. And here's something. We've had presidents who are women in India. We've had lots of chief ministers who are women in India. But there is this thing, no matter if our first prime minister who was in India was in the 70s. And very recently, we had our president who actually just gave up her tenure. And I come from a state which has always had a very powerful chief minister. But no matter how many women we have in leadership, there is always this resistance, or even the reaction. Like, there was a gentleman earlier who was saying, oh, how did you land in, you know, Harvard? How did Sirleaf land in Harvard? I mean, what is that mindset, and how do we do away with that? I mean, you would never go up to a Harvard-educated man and say, how did you get here? Right? Right? So it kills me. It really kills me. As a woman of color, as someone from South Asia, as someone from a developing country, and as someone who works in development, it drives me crazy, that attitude. So you have to tell me how you feel about it. And how do we get rid of that attitude for once and for, you know? Yeah.
I feel like it's hard for me to stand here and answer how men get rid of the sort of the ways they look at women. I think you get to the point where it doesn't matter. You just keep doing what you're going to do. With Ellen Johnson Sirleaf now, 12 years later, and she's coming to the end of her term. She's going to be stepping down, which is huge. We don't usually have African presidents that leave voluntarily. She's going to be stepping down at the end of the year. Nobody's talking about whether she's a woman anymore. You know, she's run the country for 12 years. That's the whole female thing doesn't come up anymore. And I think that's where you just have to have, we just have to have more and more women doing stuff. I think that's what it's not. You don't have people standing around. You know, when she was running, you had young boys who would take white panties and put tomato paste on it and like throw that in the street and say, this is an example that a woman can't be president. It's like absurd. But you don't see any of that anymore in Liberia. So it's just because people are too busy complaining about why is she doing this? Why is she doing that? And it's like, we've moved beyond, at least I think in Liberia, in many ways, we moved beyond that. And that's because we've had a woman for 12 years. Okay. Two more. Yes, ma'am.
I just want to thank you for writing the book. It's a really magnificent book, and I'm halfway through it for the second time.
Oh, wow.
It's a wonderful.
Thank you.
Really, well, and I enjoyed your own book enormously, too. And I'm leaving for Liberia on Friday.
Ah, that's why. Okay.
Yeah. Well, no, that's not the reason why. I'm going because I've read. But I wanted to say I loved the fact that you did at the end tell some stories about your interviews with Ellen. How did you ever get her? As busy as she was and as much as she had to, was fractured on so many directions to be able to do this. And could you just tell us an anecdote too about some of your adventures traveling with her, trying to interview her while 17,000 other things were happening.
She's not easy to pin down. She's very busy. You're absolutely right. I approached her earlier saying I want to do this book, and I sort of said at the beginning I'm going to do this book, and I hope you'll cooperate with me. But even if you don't, I'm still going to do this book. She is somebody who I didn't know her very well before. I mean, I had met her and I had interviewed her a couple of times, but she wasn't somebody, and I'd certainly heard about her growing up in Liberia, but she wasn't somebody I knew very well. However, her sister is married to my cousin. So I also enlisted my cousin Estrada to like beg on my behalf. I think in the end, she decided that she was going to cooperate because I'm a New York Times reporter. I'm Liberian. She had read my first book, and I think she knew that if there was going to be a book done about her presidency and her legacy, this is her best shot at it. Because I think I brought with it the credibility of my profession and my years of work as a journalist, and the fact that I'm also Liberian. So I think I have the ability to get things that maybe other people would not be able to get. Mm-hmm. She was really fun to travel with. She's very reserved. When you first meet her, she doesn't like to touch people. She doesn't like, you know, she's not ebullient or effusive, even though she can turn it on the political stage if she wants. And our first few interviews were really stilted, and I realized shortly into it that it was because I was interviewing her in American English. And she was responding to me in American English, because we both can do it. We could go back and forth, Liberian versus American English. And it wasn't until we were on our way up country and we had stopped at a market, and I was in the backseat of her car with her, because I spent months just following her around, shadowing her. And I'd been interviewing her with my laptop and my thing, asking my stilted questions in American English. And we got out of the car, we stopped at a market, and we're both talking to this market woman on the side of the road, and we're both speaking Liberian English to her. And when we got back in the car, we continued in Liberian English, and it was like a light went off. It was completely different, the answers I was getting once I switched over. And then I never interviewed her after that in American English.
Thank you. That's really insightful. Yeah, I thought it was a very well-balanced presentation of her.
I just read this whole thing to you in Liberian English. The parts where I was talking about elephant heads or clarion, all I wanted, I was in Liberian English.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for being here. I just wanted to say, as a Liberian American, I really enjoyed the tone of your book, the way you actually use like Liberian English with American English. And I was wondering, how did you, as a journalist, like become comfortable portraying that or not, like covering it up? How did you find your authentic voice for your book?
I still speak Liberian English when I'm talking to my family. This is that's the language I was raised in, and it's still my natural way of speaking, even though I've been in the U.S. so long that I feel perfectly natural speaking American English as well. At the New York Times, they laugh at me on the foreign desk because I'm the only reporter who has special dispensation to write in Liberian English when I'm writing about Liberia. They won't let the other reporters do it, which is kind of funny. But I found early on with my first book that it was a memoir about growing up in Liberia, and it just didn't sound real if I was doing the dialogue in American. It didn't sound right to me. And so I just started doing it in Liberian, which is interesting. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf wrote a book, a memoir herself, called This Child Will Be Great. And it begins with the story of this famous story of this old man, a prophet who came when she was born to the house. He looked at the baby and he said, "This child will be great." And I'm talking to her, I was like, "No Liberian talks like that. What are you talking about? What do you mean, this child will be great?" And she was like, "Well, I don't remember what he said. That's what my family told me he said. And I was a baby. How am I supposed to remember? They all told me he said this child would be great." So then I went to talk to her sister, Jenny Bernard. She was like, "No, that's not what the guy said. He said, 'Man, it became not easy.'" Which is like totally, it sort of says the same thing, but she had anglicized it for an American audience. I guess because a book called "Man, it became not easy" was not going to look that great. Thank you very much.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.